In Karzai answered. They exhorted them again. Greg had delivered a brilliant recruitment challenge, offering the gift of revenge, wrapped in their honor, their manhood, and their warrior identity. This was still not enough. At 0200 hours, a messenger found Greg curled on the floor asleep. He gave Greg a gentle kick.
"Hamid, Hamid," the messenger said.
Greg stirred and thought, what does Karzai want now? He followed the messenger back to Karzai's makeshift headquarters, a bombed-out Taliban army building in Tarin Kaut. Karzai was sitting in a corner, wrapped in a shawl. He had a cough. He looked tired and grim as he glanced at Greg and then surveyed the scores of tribal elders gathered in the cold, dim room. They all turned to Greg. Karzai said, "They want to know if the United States will negotiate with Mullah Omar." Greg was now fully awake. He looked over the silent crowd of warriors. Greg answered, "My president has said that you are either with us or against us, so how could we negotiate with Mullah Omar? He has brought you nothing but death and hardship. We will not negotiate with this murderer. We will fight with you until victory." Karzai translated. The men started nodding their heads. Then a low chorus of oof, oof, oof spread among them. This was their collective affirmation. They understood. They would fight. Karzai and Greg had just recruited their army. Karzai politely thanked Greg and excused him. Back in his bedroll on the floor, Greg reflected on what had just transpired. He was a GS-15 who had just spoken for the President of the United States to a bunch of Afghan tribal leaders. He had pledged the United States to them. They had placed their fate in his hands. Did he say the right thing? Did he overstep his authority? There was no time to inquire with HQS, so he had decided then and there. "Oh, what the hell," he thought. "That's why I joined the CIA. I've been preparing for this my whole life. Maybe I'll send Hank a cable tomorrow." Then he fell asleep. On 18 November 2001, a few miles south of Tarin Kaut on the road to Kandahar, Echo and their Afghan allies encountered Taliban and AQ forces. The enemy had dispatched a convoy from Kandahar. Against overwhelming numbers, some of Karzai's militia wavered and fled. Greg grabbed some of them by their collars, screaming and pushing them forward. He told Echo's men to do the same. If his recruitment of this militia did not stick, if he could not rally them, they all faced the likely prospect of a brutal death. Worse, they would fail in their mission. If AQ maintained their southern Afghanistan safe haven, the U.S. homeland would remain at risk. Without a Karzai-led victory to secure Kandahar, thereby aligning Pashtun tribal interest with non-Pashtun Afghanistan, the chances of an Afghan nation-state were diminished. This was a monumental turning point of the war, one way or another. Echo and their regrouped Afghan allies fought. The U.S. Air Force forward air controller signed to Echo called in U.S. bombers with devastating precision. 500-pound bombs smacked into the enemy convoy, while Echo and the Afghans decimated the enemy's ranks with automatic weapons fire. Within minutes, most of the Taliban convoy was a smoldering, twisted line of junk metal. Many of the enemy died in the bombardment. Echo and the Afghans had blunted the enemy attack. The surviving AQ and Taliban fighters fled to Kandahar. They had never encountered warfare like this. Neither had the Afghan allies. The speed and precision of the U.S. bombing was uncanny. The skill, valor, and leadership of Karzai and the Echo team inspired them. They had never experienced such a fast and exacting victory. Most of all, the Americans had kept their word.
Karzai and Greg had recruited a small army and won their first and most important battle. They would lead them in combat in the weeks ahead, relentlessly driving south toward Kandahar. In fight after fight, they would forge a deep partnership. Along the way, Greg and his Echo teammates would lead from the front, braving enemy fire, racing from one Allied Afghan position to another, clearing jammed weapons, directing assaults, calling in airstrikes, countering Taliban attacks, doctoring the wounded, and burying the dead. They would also encounter other, less obvious challenges. The Afghan allies' penchant for tea breaks and mandatory prayers played havoc with the U.S. military's fire support schedule. Greg explained to his perplexed and frustrated U.S. military colleagues that this was simply Afghan war. You could instruct them how to lay a field of fire against obvious enemy targets, but you could not expect a forfeiture of prayer or tea because of some unseen pilot's schedule. Echo bridged the cultural gap. Every day, through their actions, they solidified the relationship. They were the glue binding this archaic tribal militia together with the most modern air force on the planet. This was repeated throughout Afghanistan. CIA and SF teams bound pre-industrial warriors and unseen space-age pilots in a blitzkrieg across some of the most inhospitable terrain imaginable. The war, the security of the U.S. homeland, depended on it. In one incident, a small Chechen patrol repulsed Karzai's men. They fled to a nearby hill where Greg waited. The Afghans sought his guidance. Some Echo members wanted a frontal assault as a lesson for their allies. The Chechens taunted them with obscene gestures. Greg told his men and the Afghans to relax. Several minutes, as the Chechens continued their vulgar antics, Greg waved to them. They probably never realized that he was waving goodbye as a joint direct attack munition, JDAM, fell from 30,000 feet and blew them to pieces. Perhaps the worst incident in Echo's epic fight to Kandahar was the result of friendly fire. An Echo operative replaced the batteries on his GPS, unwittingly erasing the previously designated enemy coordinates. The GPS reset to its own position, marking Echo's exact spot, which the operator unwittingly transmitted to a U.S. aircraft circling above. A precision-guided bomb landed among them. Greg instinctively threw his body on top of Karzai to shield him. Echo team members and Afghan allies were killed and wounded. All were stunned by the concussion. The Taliban continued to press their attack. Echo and Afghans quickly regrouped, caring for the wounded while fighting off the enemy. They survived and continued their march south toward Kandahar. Meanwhile, Team Foxtrot and Gul Aga Sherzai's allied Pashtun militia fought their way from the Pakistan border toward Kandahar. Two allied militia forces were rapidly converging on the enemy. Kandahar fell to Echo and Karzai's forces on 7 December 2001, anniversary of a day of infamy in 1941. Now it was a day of victory. Foxtrot arrived soon thereafter from the east. The Taliban's loss of its spiritual capital, the enemy's last urban stronghold in Afghanistan, was a devastating blow to Mullah Omar and his cohorts, who fled across the border to Pakistan. Greg and his Echo team had executed one of the most remarkable recruitment operations and covert paramilitary actions in the annals of CIA history. For his valorous service and exceptional leadership, the CIA awarded Greg the Intelligence Star, the CIA's equivalent of the Medal of Honor. Coercion. Coercion, particularly in counterterrorism operations and war, can play an important role in the intelligence collection process. Tony was the deputy commander of Team Delta, another joint CIA-SF unit, deployed into the central mountains of Afghanistan in October 2001. They had joined with Karim Khalili's Hazara militia. The Hazara, a Shia minority horribly persecuted by the Taliban, welcomed the United States with gratitude and a deep commitment to the war. In a matter of weeks, Delta had accomplished their initial mission objectives, collecting intelligence, forging deeper alliances, and helping our Afghan allies defeat the Taliban in Bamiyan province. They had also secured the roads to the east, all the way to Kabul. Tony now wanted something more. He looked like a nice, if unremarkable, guy. Less than average height, wiry, broad shoulders, dark hair, and an easy smile. He seemed content. I could imagine him as a waiter serving pasta in a decent neighborhood cafe. He would be the kind of waiter, effective and friendly but not too familiar, who earns extra tips because he cares about the customers and they like him. Maybe he was a waiter in an earlier life. I did not know him well, except by reputation. I knew one thing,